two novels about colonialism, both from the point of view of the colonized.
Babel, in particular, tries to work through and illustrate the implications of what Frantz Fanon writes about in his seminal work, The Wretched of the Earth, which is not just about the psychological effects of colonialism, but what it might take to overthrow a colonial government and to establish a truly radical regime in its aftermath.
That's R.F. Kwan. Later in the show, she tells us about her fantasy slash alternate history novel, Babel, or The Necessity of Violence, an arcane history of the Oxford Translators' Revolution. But first, we're honored to talk with last year's winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature, Abdulrazak Gurna, about his novel Afterlives, just published in the U.S. by Penguin Random House. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. And hey, you know you can go to writersvoice.net to find extra content with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. In 2021, Abdulrazak Gurna received the Nobel Prize in Literature for, in the words of the Nobel Committee, his uncompromising and compassionate penetration of the effects of colonialism and the fate of the refugee in the gulf between cultures and continents. That's certainly evident in his novel Afterlives, first published in the UK in 2020 and now out in a new American edition. It tells the brutal story of colonialism in East Africa. First, German colonialism, then, after Germany's defeat in World War I, the British variety. It's a brutal story, but not a brutal novel. Instead, it spins a profoundly moving and human tale centered on three young people who find love, caring, and community after the psychological and physical traumas that the colonial system has subjected them to. Afterlife shows the terrible toll of injustice and the power of love and compassion to heal it. Abdulrazak Gurna was born in Zanzibar in 1948 and teaches at the University of Kent. He's the author of numerous novels, including Paradise, which was shortlisted for the Booker Prize, and By the Sea, a Los Angeles Times Book Prize finalist. Abdulrazak Gurna, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Hi, thanks very much.
You were a refugee from Zanzibar when a revolution overthrew the government. You came to Britain quite young, 18 years old. How did you begin writing, and how did that experience shape your work as a writer?
How did it shape my experience? Well, of course, it was a very big thing to happen in one's life, leaving your home in conditions and circumstances of difficulty or breaking the law, terror. You're not allowed to leave and you escape, as we used to put it. The price of that, although we thought we understood it, or I thought I understood it, was that you're breaking the law. Therefore, if you return, you would be liable, as it were, to some kind of comeback from the law. We weren't quite sure what that would be. So in other words, leaving was a kind of exit visa type leaving. But you don't really understand that when you're 18 years old and you're desperate to go find a life somewhere else. So I think that was one of the first things that dawned on me that I understood when I arrived in England, that I've lost something. And also, not sure. What have I done? Is this a clever thing to have done? You know, it was also very exciting. Everything was new. I'd read this and that about England, colonized by the British, told things about England. But there's still a great deal that was quite unlike what I thought you would find. So there's a lot to learn, kind of an adventure in a way, for a young person. So those are the two things. One is this sense of having lost something on the one one hand, and then the other is this something opening up, which is exciting. I didn't understand that, I think, at the time at all, that I was actually not very welcome, that I was busy dealing with the sort of anxieties any stranger feels in another place, particularly a young, inexperienced, I hadn't been anywhere before that, a young, inexperienced stranger. But in fact, there were other things going on that took a little while to understand. That is the hostility, the unwelcomeness of the place I had come to. You can imagine that those are the kinds of experiences and encounters and reflections and so on that might lead one to start thinking about, should I write this down?
And these three themes of loss, adventure, and the hostility of the colonizers are very much themes in this latest book, at least latest book in the on the American shores of Afterlives. It's a beautifully told story, a story of colonialism in East Africa, first German colonialism, then British colonialism, through the lives of largely three young people it afflicted. Ilyas is stolen from his family by German colonial troops at a young age. Afia is his younger sister, who he rescues, and Hamza, who was sold into slavery by his family at a very young age. And both Ilyas and Hamza become soldiers in the German army in Africa during World War I. I think most Americans are unaware of Germany's colonial history in East Africa. First, tell us, what kinds of societies did the colonialists encounter there? And then how did they, what did they do to those societies?
Yeah, well, this is the late 19th century, we're talking about 1880s or so. I'm sure many of your listeners, or many people in the United States at least, have an understanding of that moment in European history when they all sat down together in Berlin and drew maps of the world, but mostly of Africa, and divided up the world between them. So that's when Germany enters in a big way. The other people, the French, the British, the Spanish, of course, and the Portuguese, have been doing it since the 15th century. The Germans enter into this, at least outside of Europe, in the 1880s, in the 19th century. And they go to it in a way which is, as was the case with Germany altogether, kind of in a militarized way, conquering and suppressing any opposition. So their experience of colonialism in Africa anyway, which is Dutch-East Africa, the east coast of Africa, the east part of Africa, the Cameroons, Togo, which is also West African nation, country, territory, and Southwest Africa. The experiences of all of these places were endless violence and war, particularly with those Southwest Africa and Dutch-East Africa. I guess that's because that's the way the state was organized. If you don't like what we're doing, big blow on the head, big crush, and you behave yourself. As you may know, that one of the notorious acts, now is called genocide, we didn't have that word when it was happening, one of the most notorious acts of extermination occurred in the German colony Southwest Africa, which is now called Namibia, where the attempt was a deliberate desire to exterminate the Herero people by starving them, by poisoning their wells, by destroying their fields, by all kinds of things like this. This is perhaps it's not unknown, because perhaps there were experiences like this in the colonization of North America as well. But in any case, in the 20th century, in the early 19th century, this form of colonization maybe perhaps was not quite in the fashion anymore, because although European armies were still killing people all over Africa, not this kind of dedicated extermination of peoples, because they wanted labor. They want people to do their work, to run their plantations for them, and this kind of thing. So it doesn't make sense to kill them. So they did that. They did that in Dojo, South Africa. And the reason they could do it is because what they were dealing with was territory, which was not a nation. These were many small nations going about their business, which may be familiar also in the North American context. These are many smaller nations going about, and perhaps even antagonistic to their neighbors. But the experience of German colonization of North Africa was one war after another, which suited them, because they didn't have to fight an all-out war. You fight this group, you defeat them, you go to the next group, you defeat them, and you go to the next, like that. And that's the 30 years until 1918 was just one war after another.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Abdulrazak Gurnah about his novel, Afterlives. He was the winner of the 2021 Nobel Prize for Literature. And there was quite a bit of resistance to colonial rule.
Well, I guess that's why they had to fight wars.
Tell us about, then, on the other hand, those who carried out the orders of their German commanders, the Askaris. What does that name mean, Askari, and why did they fight so fiercely for the colonizer?
Yeah, well, that's also what interested me, and in thinking about this, and but then when you look into it, it's actually it's possible to come to some kind of explanation. Askari, by the way, is I think it's an Arabic word, but it just means soldier. But anyway, so when the Germans first arrived in 1888 or so, they recruited a mercenary force of Nubians from Sudan. These people were experienced mercenaries because they had actually already been mercenaries of the British. And they were kind of, what's the word, when armies are stood down? Demobilized, yeah. They've been kind of pensioned off, as it were, after the British defeated the Mahdi in the Sudan. And there were all these former British mercenaries in Alexandria without work. And the German commander, the German man who was appointed by Bismarck to bring a little bit of order to this new territory that they'd acquired, Bismarck, his name was, he went to Alexandria, saw these unemployed Nubian mercenaries and employed them and brought them over to our part of the world as his Schutztruppe, which I think means something like security force. You know, the usual euphemisms colonizers use. So the very first army that the Germans used in pacifying or in fighting rebellion in Deutsche Ostafrika were these total strangers to the area, which is why they could act with such horrible violence, because they were dealing with strangers. They weren't dealing with people who had anything to do with them. They were just employees of this person, of this administration. They were saying, go there, destroy them, destroy this, destroy that. So the Schutztruppe, the earliest members of the Schutztruppe were these Nubian mercenaries. But what often happens with conquest is that the conquered are then drawn into the orbit, as it were, of the conqueror, both because now the conqueror has prestige, particularly for young people who see the newness of it all, the technology, the armaments, the uniform, the money. So the new recruits into the Schutztruppe are of the defeated people in each of these wars, who then become part of the Schutztruppe. So if you like, the Nubian concentration sort of is gradually diminished by the recruitment of native people in the areas that are defeated people. I think one of your questions was, why did they do this? Why did they join colonial armies? Not only, of course, for the Germans, the same was true of the British, the same was true of the Portuguese armies in Africa, the same was true of the Belgian armies, Force Publique, as they call them. All of them were African mercenary soldiers officered by Europeans. Why did they do it? It was one of the questions I asked myself too, and wanted to understand. Why did people do this? And I think one of the This is how I answered myself. I think in the first place, there wasn't this idea of African, quite possibly at that time. There was a different idea of I'm Mjaga, I'm Wahehe, I'm Tukuyu, I'm this, I'm that, I'm that. That was a stronger force than any notion of an African identity, which would have had to be constructed out of a sense of opposition, maybe, which it was ultimately, of course. This is what the decolonizing process did. It actually made people think of themselves as Africans, as opposed to as fragmented communities or fragmented nations, if you like. And the fact that they were fragmented meant that there was no national resistance to what the Germans were doing, or the British were doing, or anybody else amongst those European nations. And you might also say that the beginning of the retreat of colonial power was when this national sense was discovered by the people who were now in these territories. So the decolonization process everywhere in Africa was national processes rather than, as it were, more fragmented processes. Ultimately, of course, the other loyalties began to destabilize everything after independence.
Yes, I'd like to come back to that later on. But in the meantime, this novel, Afterlives, really explores the contradictions, I would say, very much the contradictions of the relationship, mostly of the colonized to the colonizer, but also the other way around. Hamza, one of the main characters in the book, becomes a servant for a German commander. And you describe a complex relationship between ruler and servant that really illuminates the mindset of the white colonizers, even when they think they're being benevolent. So tell us about Hamza and the commander and their relationship, and how Hamza also experiences that.
My thought was that in any situation, particularly situations of conflict, where those who have the power, the authority to carry out acts of oppression or of cruelty, they would be informed by an ideology that says this is what is right to do. They will be informed by certain kind of cultural and social habits and understandings and so on that says this is the right thing to do. But they would also encounter amongst those that they are oppressing, or those that they are despising, or those that they have to subject in some way or another to their authority, they would also encounter or come across situations when there would be some kind of challenge to this, either because they see the humanity of the person that they're acting out this oppression, or because it connects with some other moment in their own lives, or because they're simply, being human beings, they simply see that there is something inhumane about what they're doing. I believe that even hard-headed people must have this sort of moment or these sorts of moments in carrying out ugly duties that they have to carry out, especially in situations where ideologically they assume that they are superior to other people.
Well, he teaches Hamza how to read.
Okay, well, let me try and get there. So while it's not possible to resist all these other forces, he's an officer, after all, in a military unit. He's indeed the commanding officer of this particular unit. He can't be seen to challenge, as it were, the kind of ideological drive of what they are doing. But nonetheless, he knows that what he's dealing with is somebody who is, well, a gentle person, somebody that he's fond of in some ways, perhaps more than he realizes. But at the same time, anybody, like the pastor is the same, cannot admit to this, because to admit to this is to say what we're doing here is wrong. So acts of kindness kind of replace this I suppose, this feeling that, are we doing the right thing? Is this doesn't look right? So acts of kindness then come in place of this. Now, in this case, it's to teach him German, which starts as a joke, but which then becomes a little project and so on.
So that starts as a joke, teaching Hamza how to read, because he doesn't really think that, you know, Hamza would have, you know, is too savage to have the understanding. Yet Hamza does have the understanding. He's an apt pupil. How does Hamza experience his relationship with the commander?
Well, there are various ways. He experiences it as relief, I suppose, but also he's terrified. He doesn't know what this man is after. He worries about the changes of mood, which is, of course, the an expression itself of a kind of power. Powerful people can be capricious if they want. They can be kind 1 minute. They can be ugly the next minute. But also he's just not sure. He's personally terrified as well. What is he doing? What is he after? And also he realizes that this is provoking some of the other Germans into similar sorts of worries about, is it lowering the prestige of the German army to see the commanding officer kind of treating this young man with such intimate attention, at the very least.
Yeah. So this book, this novel, Afterlives, is also a love story between Hamza and Afia, who is a sister of Ilyas, who we met in the beginning. Both Hamza and Afia have suffered much. They've been traumatized. They've been abandoned. Yet they both maintain their human dignity and kindness. Tell us about these two characters and the love that they share.
My original thought was that they have somebody who has gone through the experience of war and returns to the town where he lived, at least for part of his youth. But it was important that he was injured, that he came back with a wound. And the wound, of course, can be seen as both a physical wound, but also something else, something deeper than that, which is sort of the physical dimension. And then there is also the wound that lives on inside. I had from the very beginning an idea that there would be a woman who also was injured, who also had gone through a trauma of her own, and who lives in this town, but they don't know each other. So the idea then, to put it as simply as possible, is that these two become each other's salvation, that somehow both of them would find some capacity to retrieve their lives as a result of meeting. And that in the process of this self-retrieval, they would tell each other the stories of their lives. This was the original way I was thinking of it. But then when I came to actually do it, I decided that I wouldn't do it as kind of backstories that they tell each other, but I would actually do it as we go along, so that when they meet, we already know their stories.
Yes, you know, and it's interesting, each of them transcends the oppressive, you know, mores, I guess, of their society. I mean, Hamza was made into a slave as a child, yet as he says to one of the other characters who refers to him being a slave as a shame, you know, to be owned body and soul is a shame. Hamza says he was never owned body and spirit, in spite of being a slave. And Afia fights back and transcends the expectations of women in her society.
Yeah, sure. Well, you put it very well there, sure.
And I wanted to ask you also, there's another character, their son, child of Hamza and Khalifa, is named Ilyas after her brother. And he becomes a writer, a journalist. I just wondered if he was in some way a stand-in for you.
No, so I just like the fact that he's curious and very imaginative and therefore able somehow to engage with this agony that his parents are going through because of the absence of the elder Ilyas. So I thought he could be a writer, writers are very imaginative people.
They certainly are. You know, I wanted to ask you a question which has long bothered me, which is, how did the experience of colonial domination lead to the violence and corruption of African governments, often of African governments today? I mean, I guess I'm asking a question about the breakdown of the previous norms that held people together through the experience of colonialism. I mean, is this the heritage of colonialism? Why couldn't people throw off the yoke of corruption when they threw off the yoke of colonialism?
You asked me that question. We've got 3 minutes left. And you expect me to answer that. It's because, partly anyway, it's because what colonialism and what all empires do is they oppress difference. Look at what happened when the Soviet Union collapsed. Suddenly you discover that they all hated each other, that the Kazakhstans and the Uzbekistans and the Estonians and so did not really want to be part of this empire. But that's what empires do. Empires force everybody's voices down and make everybody obey. You remove that authoritarian force, then voices appear. And what has been suppressed is the rights of people to speak, the rights of people to ask for what they need, to demand what they need. And if the territory is large enough, like say, for example, the Congo, the differences are big enough, then there is no possibility of any kind of stability or any kind of talking together. There are too many differences, too many different people, too many languages, too many desires, too few resources. So this can work sometimes with smaller states. With larger states, what colonialism had suppressed for administrative convenience then comes out. And of course, what colonialism also did is it created territorial units, which are called nations, which have no organic unity. So division and violence and obstruction is already built in into a territory that is now called Congo, where people have been brought together for the convenience of the colonizers, but actually have nothing in common. And the result is the chaos. Of course, the result is also the unpreparedness of many of these African nations to carry on and make some kind of civil case with each other and say, hey, look, let's talk sense. It's because there are too many contentions. There are too many people, too many societies being forced to live together when they don't really want to live together.
Abdulrazak Gurna. Read an excerpt from Afterlives by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, another novel about colonialism, this time a fantasy novel set in an alternate 19th century during the time of the British Empire. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. It isn't often that fantasy fiction provides a deep dive into real history, let alone the history of British colonialism. But that's what Rebecca Kwong's novel, Babel, does. It spreads its wings across a few different genres: fantasy, dark academia, as we'll hear, and historical fiction, in a page-turning read that leaves the reader knowing a whole lot more about how that empire operated than many straight histories do. In Babel's version of history, magical inscriptions on silver bars provide the energy that coal did in the real British Empire. And the magic is driven by matched words in translation. It's an intriguing concept, one that illuminates the power of language, both to exert domination and to spark liberation. Rebecca F. Kwong is the award-winning author of the best-selling Poppy War trilogy. Rebecca Kwong, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks for having me.
This is a fantasy, a history, a discourse on colonialism, Babel, or The Necessity of Violence, an arcane history of the Oxford Translators' Revolution, a terrific read. It's a fantasy novel with a lot of real history wrapped up in an alternate reality, and one that aims square at predatory global capitalism, via the British colonial system of the 19th century and its consequences. What led you to take up this subject?
Before I started working on Babel or Babel, people pronounce it differently depending on where they are and where they come from, I had just wrapped up an epic fantasy trilogy that dealt with a lot of the issues and questions of 20th century China, but which was set in a much more fantastical Song Dynasty setting. And I found very quickly that I didn't really love working in secondary world epic fantasy. I talk very directly and without subtlety about real world issues and real histories. I studied history in undergrad, and then I shifted to literature for my postgrad degrees, but that strong sense of empiricism and historical grounding has never really left me. So I thought for my next project, instead of constructing a new world altogether, I would play within the confines of our existing history, which led me down a lot of rabbit holes about the 19th century. I picked Oxford in the 1830s in particular for a few reasons. The first is that I happened to be studying at Oxford, and it's just such a magical city, I think. It is so beautiful and so mystical, and especially at night when you're just walking down the cobblestones and there's no one else around, you really do feel like you're in communion with scholars spanning centuries. So, and I'm a person who's very influenced by setting. Where I am always determines on what I'm going to work on next. So once I became fascinated in the question of Oxford, I started looking into not only the history of Oxford, but also the history of a lot of elite institutions, including Cambridge, Harvard, Yale, and, well, elite institutions have a lot more skeletons in their closet than they would like to present, and they are almost always inextricably tied up with projects of settler colonialism, imperialism, and slavery. So I started doing a lot of research into how elite institutions not only benefited from the slave trade and from colonialism, but in fact were active participants. They graduated the kind of person who would become a slave trader or a colonial administrator or an imperialist member of parliament, and they replicated regimes of knowledge that justified these projects of empire building and of expanding slavery. And since I've always really loved the campus novel and the genre of dark academia, I thought it was a really ripe genre in which to talk about the actual dark history of universities and the real shadows that universities operate within.
Dark academia. I didn't realize it was actually a genre.
I think it's more of a subgenre. I think, you know, it's not one of the readily recognizable genres like fantasy, thrillers, science fiction, etc. But I think of dark academia as, well, first, The Secret History by Donna Tartt is widely recognized as the progenitor of this genre. But following that, novels like If We Were Villains by Emil Rio and Catherine House by Elizabeth Thomas and The Likeness by Tana French, I think some common tropes or features of dark academia novels, first of all, are lovely elite universities and their campuses. And within that, a love for the classics, a love for the pure world of ideas, the tension of existing within the ivory tower and the academy, and the disconnect between grappling with those problems and the problems of the world outside. I think also what characterizes dark academia novels is the protagonist is often an outsider who encounters elusive, exclusive societies and wants badly to join, and then once they're on the inside becomes increasingly uncomfortable with their role within it. So those were some of the tropes that I always love encountering when I read them and that I wanted to play with when I started writing my own dark academia.
Oh, that's great. And so talking about such a character, we have Robin here. Tell us about Robin, and then tell us about the student cohort he is part of, that is Rami, Victoire, and Letty.
When I started thinking about the structure that Babel would follow, I decided that it would be a subversion of the classic Victorian Buildings Roman, a coming-of-age story. So something in the style of Charles Dickens's Great Expectations, for example, or David Copperfield. And I think Buildings Romans of that sort are generally defined by a socio-aesthetic process by which the protagonist becomes a good citizen of the social and moral order. They're usually a bourgeois character, and you know that maturation process of finding your place in society. So Robin's story follows that exact pattern of you see him from childhood, you see him grow up, you see his guardians, you see him become a man. But what sets him apart from characters like Pip, for example, is that he's not white and he's not from England. And when he comes, he doesn't speak the languages fluently. And he'll always be marked as an outsider for a lot of these reasons. So he can't ever participate fully in the civil and moral order of Victorian England. And he's always positioned on the margins, which is a position from which I've always been most comfortable writing, because when you have a character on the outside, it lets them come to observations about given societies that native members of those societies might not notice. So one chapter that I had a lot of fun writing was when Robin is growing up and learning English and learning about English culture and society by reading and making mistakes. So he's learning all these phrases and he thinks they're so funny. He doesn't know why Tories are called what they are. He thinks Marylebone is named for marble and bone. He's confused by Cockney rhyming slang, for example. And this was also very convenient for me because I'm obviously not British. And the trouble of writing a novel set in London or in Oxford or anywhere else in England is that British readers will notice very quickly if you're not a native and aren't using the slang comfortably and not using the right words for things. But with Robin, I have an excuse for that. He's an outsider. He's not familiar with the slang or the mores, and he's making mistakes and figuring them out. And this is something I also had personal experience with, the culture shock of being an American student in the UK for 2 years while I was working on my postgrad degrees. So that is the position from which I wrote Robin, which is very convenient for me and also very fascinating for me. As far as the cohort goes, this is one of my favorite things about writing, period. I have always written about students in part because I've spent most of my own life being a student. And I'm especially fascinated in the particular alchemy between students from different backgrounds who come to university and find fast friends and who is around them, because college really is this very unique period where you're away from your family for the first time and you're figuring out who you are. You need to start defining the contours of your own subjectivity, and you have all this insecurity about being an independent agent for once outside the purview of your parents. And you meet so many other young people who are going through the same thing, and you form these deep, meaningful bonds that I think once you graduate are really difficult to find. I've talked to a lot of friends since college about how hard it is to make friends as an adult compared to college, where you can really fall in love with your friends overnight. And I tried to represent that through Robin's relationships with his cohort. It really only takes a couple of conversations lasting past midnight for all of them to become obsessed with each other. And once they have that deep love, there are all these other emotional wrinkles. There are petty jealousies. There are more complicated feelings of love and resentment and jealousy and hatred. But at the end of the day, love tying it all together. And
yet their relationship with each other isn't really like the relationship of other students. They're all defined by their relationship as coming from colonized people, except for Letty, who is her distinction of being on the margins is that she's a woman at Oxford. There's Victoire, who's from Haiti. There's Rami, who is from India. And Robin, of course, from China. So now, tell us about the central metaphor and and device of this book, which is the magical use of silver and the use of words and translation to make silver into a kind of stand-in, let's say, for fossil fuels. It drives the power and the energy of the empire. This is really a fascinating concept, and I wonder if you could just deconstruct it. Why language? Why translation? Why silver? And how does it work? First, tell us how it works.
Sure. So the magic system of Babel is referred to as silver working. And basically the mechanics are a silver worker will take a bar of silver and inscribe a word or a phrase in one language on one side of it, and the corresponding word or phrase in a different language on the other side. And since, as all translators know, or really anyone who is bilingual knows, there is no perfect one-to-one correlation between words and phrases in any two languages, no matter how closely related they are to each other. And there's always something that is missing when you translate that needs distortion, that gets lost. And what the silver bar then does is manifest what's lost in translation as a magical effect. And I started thinking about this because it was right around when I started drafting Babel that I had begun translating professionally, and I was translating Chinese science fiction short stories into English for the magazine Clark's World. And I'd always known that translation was tricky and harder than a lot of people give it credit for, because I think a lot of people outside translation just think it means, you know, rote matching between words and phrases. And obviously it takes a lot more work and art than that. And I started reading a lot of philosophies of translation and scholarly discourse about how it's done, what purposes it's for, and what faithfulness means in translation, what it means to betray the source text, if it's possible to have accurate or faithful translations at all, how present should the translator be, should they try to make themselves invisible, or since because they're intervention is inevitably seen, should they try to work more creatively with the text? There are all these fascinating questions, but what lies at the heart of it is that there's just this mystical realm of meaning that no one language can perfectly approximate. And I think that mystical realm is that ineffable stuff that goes on in people's heads. And I think when we just speak normally to each other, we're already engaged in the process of translating our thoughts and feelings and fears and desires into a shared language with others. We're all constantly self-translating. So whatever that mystical realm of meaning is, that is so inherently magical to me, it seemed like a very obvious candidate for something to make a fictional magic system with. And then as for the material component, which is silver, silver has all these symbolic qualities. I set the novel in the 1830s in the lead up to the Opium War of 1840, which the British Empire fought against China in order to secure the rights to continue selling opium within China's borders. And it's this war that reversed the silver deficit between Britain and China, which allowed the British Empire to fund really the next great wave of British colonialism. So silver is historically relevant for that reason. But there's also all these little things, such as the fact that silver argent is smelted with mercury, and mercury is the Roman name for the god Hermes, who is the god of messengers and traveling, and translation just is the travel of meaning and text from one land to another, from one audience to another. And from Hermes, we get hermeneutics, which is a study of meaning and interpretation. So it all fits so well together that it seems less like something that I deliberately constructed and more like something that was just waiting to be discovered.
Well, that's just fascinating. This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Rebecca Kwong about her fantasy novel about British colonialism, Babel. This is such a wonderful way to get at the points that you're making about how the exploitation of other peoples is brought into bear on the wings of language. And in fact, that's what is behind why the empire, the British Empire, needs these translators who come from the colonized lands. Tell us why.
Well, in the magic system of Babel, silver working doesn't work as well for people who aren't native speakers. It really requires people who can really think and feel and dream in certain languages. And according to the rules I've established, silver working grows less effective over time as there's more movement between languages, as people start picking up loan words and using them more commonly, which means obviously that languages like French and German and Latin would slowly become less effective in a place like England over time, because those are the languages that and Spanish too, that the average English person has the most regular contact with, which means that in order to keep silver working potent, in order to keep feeding the machine of empire, the British Empire really needs to look to resources like Chinese and a whole number of languages spoken in India. And these are the languages that Robin and Rami and Victoire speak, which is why they have a very privileged status within Babel, because by virtue of being outsiders and foreigners, they have assets that other scholars don't. But this puts them in a very fraught position, because it's these assets that make them valuable, but it's also these qualities that make them perpetual outsiders and unable to ever fully assimilate if assimilation is a goal they were pursuing in the first place.
It's a metaphor for resources in general. In other words, you know, the resources of the home countries are exhausted, and the resources of the colonized country, there's the inexorable drive to exploit the resources that have not been exploited yet of the colonized realms. And this is really a central question in the book around the necessity of exploitation. That's the exploiter's point of view, of course, versus using technology to benefit all. And this is something that Robin, and we haven't said yet, but Robin's father, actual real father, is Professor Lovell, who is one of the dons in Oxford of this translation institute, while his mother was Chinese. And Robin asks him at a point, why hoard the knowledge? So I wonder if you could talk about this hoarding of knowledge as an element of imperialism.
I think the question is less why hoard knowledge and more why share knowledge if it doesn't profit you, if it doesn't lead to direct profits for you. And this is not a question for 1830s England. It's a question for drug producers today. It's a question for tech giants and everybody else who has all this knowledge that could benefit people's lives in untold numbers of ways and choose instead to sit on patents and hoarding knowledge, because we live in an economy where it doesn't make sense to share things. I was just reading a piece the other day on how ridiculous it is that people who contribute academic articles to journals often don't even get free copies of their own published work and instead have to pay like $39.95 in order to download a PDF. I mean, it's ridiculous. And I think the answer is really simple. There's just no profit motive in it. Therefore, people do not share.
So Robin has a half-brother who's involved in the Revolutionary Underground Organization, the Hermes Society, and now I know why you called it the Hermes Society. And he really wrestles with his privilege. I mean, he is called on to become part of that Revolutionary Society. He struggles with himself, with the privilege that he has. But it comes at a price. Talk a little bit about how Robin struggles with this idea of, shall I stay inside the system that gives me all these benefits and maybe I can transform it from within, versus cutting his ties and becoming a revolutionary from without? And this is really kind of a central question of the book as one goes deeper into the story.
We all think it would be so easy to make the right decision when it comes down to it. And we think Well, if we're in the same positions as protagonists of our favorite fantasy novels, of course we would be the heroes. Of course we would never sell each other out. Of course we would stand up for the revolution. Of course we would do the right thing to save each other. And in Robin's case, I'm trying to articulate why, in fact, it is so difficult for so many people to give up the status quo and make radical choices. And for Robin, it's literally a matter of survival. He lives a very cushy life in England. He grows up in this nice estate where he gets 3 square meals a day, access to all the books he can ask for, a better education than most of his peers. And then when he's at Oxford, he doesn't pay for a thing. He has very nice student lodgings. He has a generous stipend. He has access to some of the nicest libraries in the world. And literally all that is asked of him is that he studies hard and thinks really hard, and he doesn't even have to make his own bed. And if he should ever refuse to cooperate, all of these things disappear overnight. There's no reason for him to be in the country. There's no one providing a roof for him to sleep under. He has no means of income. He will probably be deported back to Canton, and these things are very terrifying for him. So for him, it's a question of his personal survival and comfort, but also his literal livelihood versus his gradual radical awakening and his moral qualms that become harder and harder to sit with. But I wanted to make that a real struggle instead of something that could be easily brushed aside, because I'm very frustrated when in fantasy novels our heroes are just unquestioningly moral and do the right thing and are full of valor when, if it really were so easy to stand up for ourselves and others, then I think our world would be in a very different situation than it is now.
And another question that this takes up is how revolutionary change happens. Does one apply the levers from within, or does one develop a mass movement that's a nonviolent? I think one of the characters mentions ahimsa, nonviolence, as happened in India, or is it by a violent vanguard? I'm not asking you to make the ju to choose one among the others, but talk a little bit about your exploration of these options, these different kinds of ways of approaching change.
Well, obviously, the title of the novel argues that violence is indeed necessary for revolutionary change. I have no idea how to answer the question of violence versus nonviolence. There have been many revolutionary movements throughout history. Some have been violent, some have been nonviolent. They've all been successful to different extents. And I think the answer is probably not binary. It probably involves some combination of tactics. But I will just say that Babel, in particular, tries to work through and illustrate the implications of what Frantz Fanon writes about in his seminal work, The Wretched of the Earth, which is not just about the psychological effects of colonialism, but what it might take to overthrow a colonial government and to establish a truly radical regime in its aftermath instead of bourgeois replication of the colonial oppressors. So there's a chapter literally titled On Violence, and it's the thoughts in that chapter that make up the backbone of the novel's argument. And there are quite a lot of arguments that are literally repeated by Griffin in one of the middle chapters as he's teaching his younger brother how to shoot a gun.
Yes, and I've always also thought that another important question is the question of power, because a revolution that does not really examine how one wields power, not only before one has it, that is, wields power in order to get it, but what one does with that power after one gets it, it's on that that revolutions succeed or fail.
That's true. That's not really something that Babel interrogates, though. Most of the characters operate from a position of powerlessness, and whatever happens at the climax and whatever happens afterwards is really left open to the reader's interpretation.
That's true. Now, there are numerous historical footnotes in Babel. Sometimes I found myself wondering, is this real or not? You know, obviously, when you're referring to historical events in the footnotes that deal with silver working in the magical sense, I knew that they were made up. But there must have been an awful lot in there that also was real history.
I would say the large majority of the footnotes are real history, and it's pretty easy to tell when something is made up because it does, in fact, have to do with silver working. And that's because I wanted the novel to feel less like a fantasy novel and more like an alternate history novel with just some small elements of magic worked in. But it was important to me not to represent silver working as this huge groundbreaking thing that completely changed the fabric of society, but rather just another technology of imperialism. And that's why it pretty much exists on the same level as a lot of the other technologies of the Industrial Revolution. It has a lot of the same social effects and drawbacks, and it has the same risks of worsening social inequality and causing accumulation of capital and riches towards people who had it already. And I wanted it to feel so natural and baked into society that people weren't constantly commenting on, oh, and we have this thing that's silver, but it's just another aspect of everyday life in Victorian England. So I guess like a good metaphor for this would just be weaving a silver thread through the tapestry of what already existed rather than creating a new world entirely.
Well, the book is Babel, or The Necessity of Violence, An Arcane History of the Oxford Translators' Revolution. It was just so fascinating to read this book on so many levels, and to talk with you too, Rebecca Kwong. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
R.H. Kwong. Read an excerpt from Babel by going to writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox, or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.